It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. trade war with Canada continues to escalate, with our neighbor to the north applying new retaliatory tariffs on dairy products, among other things, this week in response to tariffs the U.S. put in place last month.
Cheese exports to Canada are now tariffed at 25%, and other dairy products are facing a 50% tariff.
Canada is Wisconsin's largest export partner, buying more than a third of the state's agricultural exports. Last year, Canada spent over $7.5 billion on Wisconsin goods overall, almost double what the state exports to its next largest market in Mexico.
We're checking in on what impact these new tariffs could have on Wisconsin farmers and the dairy industry in the state as a whole.
Darren Von Ruden is a fourth-generation dairy farmer near Westby. He's the president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Darren, welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The news has changed from day to day, week to week here. What's been the reaction from Wisconsin farmers as this trade war with Canada has escalated and these new dairy tariffs have come on board?
Well, I guess probably number one is a little bit of uncertainty, or a lot of uncertainty. What's going to happen in 3 months, basically, is where a lot of farmers are looking at this point, because it usually takes a little bit before that what happens today hits the paychecks that we get. And, that uncertainty of how much Canada is going to retaliate, we know what that is now, the 25% on cheeses, but 50% on other products. We do have a lot of butter from Wisconsin that goes into Canada. And if that gets tariffed at 50%, it'll cause that to be uncompetitive in the Canadian market, which means that we'll probably have more of that coming back here to the state of Wisconsin, or it will never leave, which makes it look like there's an oversupply of those products, which normally drives down prices that the farmer receives for the milk that they produce.
As I understand it, Darren, these Canadian tariffs just kicked in on Tuesday. As you mentioned, it can take a few days or some time before this changes the market. Are Wisconsin farmers seeing less interest in purchases from across the border in Canada already, or is that something that'll happen, what, next week, 2 weeks?
Yeah, I think that's probably going to, happen in the next 2 weeks that we'll hear about it. I can imagine that it's probably happening today already, that the Canadian consumer is buying less American dairy products because of, what's been happening. And certainly, as we're hearing from more and more sources up there, they're starting to dislike this president more and more every day by his actions. And ultimately, that's going to have an impact on what the Canadian consumer buys. And if the dairy industry, which is a vital part here in the state of Wisconsin, is a part of that process, we're going to see negative impacts at the farm level.
There has been concern for American dairy farmers saying, hey, wait, Canada has supply management rules meant to keep stable prices for Canadian farmers that ends up being unfair to American dairy. Do you have a hope that when this all shakes up, Canadian rules could loosen, we could end up with a better trade climate for Wisconsin dairy farmers?
I think there's a majority of the dairy farmers here in the U.S. that wish we had a similar program, not the same thing that they have, because they do have some issues with it. And being it was formed, 60, 70 years ago and hasn't really kept up to the modernization part, there's things that are definitely wrong with it. Most dairy farmers in the country, most agriculture producers too, don't want to see their counterparts in other countries harmed by international corporations that are trying to pit each other, one another against each other. And, until we can figure out how to make sure that we have a stable supply, but have a price that's stable enough or at a range that the American farmer can make a living, we need to let other countries' systems alone.
You painted a chain of events earlier. Hey, these tariffs in place on Wisconsin dairy products going to Canada might mean fewer people in Canada buy those products. We end up with more of a glut of those dairy products in Wisconsin. Prices could go down. What are margins like for Wisconsin dairy farmers right now? How much would that price drop, if that chain of events happens, affect our farmers here in the state?
Well, currently with the futures market and what farmers are receiving right now, we're already in a negative. So looking forward, if that does have the impact that historically has shown, It's just going to mean a bigger negative for farmers' paychecks. So year end, it looks like we're going to be losing money. It's just a matter, are we going to be losing 5% or 25% on our profits for the year?
Depending on the product, assuming this might be a short-term thing, how much can farmers sit on inventory or the supply system? Obviously, milk and cream, we know that has a clock, and it doesn't last forever. Cheese might last a little longer. Whey protein powders a little longer than that. Can people kind of sit on stockpiles for a little while to see how this shakes out?
Yeah, there certainly is some flexibility in that process, and dry powder is probably the best mechanism to sit on, but that's also the lowest priced product. So if the processors are putting more pounds of milk into that product, that means that farmers' milk checks are going to be smaller because of that processing capabilities. Cheese, certainly some cheeses can be aged, for instance, cheddar. A lot of people like the 9-year-old aged cheddar, but that's not the majority of the consumers out there. It's really a small portion of the consuming public that likes that. And plus, at that point too, it does get to be a pricier product versus the stuff that is consumed within 60 to 90 days of when that milk was produced.
Darren, again, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Darren Von Ruden, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, a dairy farmer in Westby. He's with us today to share the impact that new retaliatory tariffs from Canada could have on Wisconsin dairy farmers. Now we'll take a step back to get a better understanding of how Canada plays into Wisconsin's dairy industry and the ripple effects these tariffs could have on consumers. Kelvin Amon is an assistant professor of dairy, business, and economic development in the UW-Platteville School of Agriculture. Kelvin, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, pre this trade dispute with U.S. and Canada, we had NAFTA and then the updated NAFTA under the first Trump administration, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA. Can you explain how that was working for Wisconsin producers who were selling to Canada?
So under the USMCA, there was a pre-existing quota that Wisconsin farmers were sending their product, cheese, whey powder, and some milk concentrates, as well as skim milk, to Canada. And these were within the quota. There were no tariffs. So farmers were be able to, well, Wisconsin producers were able to send their product across to Canada if they were within this quota. But if it goes out of the quota, then they were going to be charged some surtax. But now what we're seeing with the retaliatory tax from tariffs from Canada is that even products that are within the quota are getting tariffed. And for instance, cheese, the 25%, we're seeing whey powder getting 50%. So we're seeing that Canada's retaliatory tariff approach is actually affecting those within the quota. Previously, if you had to go above the quota to receive surtax, but now what we're seeing is that even if you're within that quota system or produce or sending within those metric tons quotas, you are going to still receive some new Canadian tariffs on there, with about 50% or majority of them, except for cheese, which is 25%. And when you look at the US tariffs that were put on Canadian goods, it was mainly regarding cheese. Cheese was what brought about all of these. But yet the US did not put any tariff on Canadian cheese. But Canada decided to put a tariff on US cheese, and mainly coming from Wisconsin, because Wisconsin produces the largest portion of cheese in the United States. And it's going to really affect Wisconsin producers going forward.
Now, the USMCA not only set levels like that, quotas like that you were just mentioning, I also understood it to be a mechanism resolution pathway, right? When if we're arguing about trade, we go to the USMCA, we work things out. Now there's just tariffs back and forth. Now product bans. Is the USMCA basically just scrap paper?
No. So the USMCA is not scrap paper. There are certain things that are still under the USMCA that are working, but it's just that the US wanted Canada to be able to market its cheese products the same way it markets the European cheese products. So just not receiving them, but allowing for them to be more marketable to the Canadian audience or to the Canadian consumer. And that was the whole idea. So it's not just scrap paper. It's still existing, but it has to be reworded. It has to be renegotiated so that the U.S. cheese markets see a better consumer output or a better appreciation from the Canadian market as Canadians are doing for European products or European cheese products. So this was the whole idea for which these tariffs were levied on Canada, so that we can see a better way for U.S. cheese products, which will significantly benefit Wisconsin producers to make the most out of.
If things stay as they are now, they can change quickly, but if the Canadian retaliatory tariffs stay in place for a while, what are your concerns for how that could impact the dairy industry, dairy farmers here in Wisconsin?
So we know that cheese products and some dry whey prices actually affect class 3 milk. And that effect is going to be huge. So as we heard earlier from Darren, I believe, mm-hmm. Yes, we realize that the prices are, you know, currently even in the negatives. And with this current tariffs, we're seeing that a 1 cent drop in the price of cheese is going to lower the class 3 milk by about 10 cents per 100 weights. And for dry cheese, it's going to be about 6 cents per 100 weights. And this is going to further beat down the prices for class 3 milks that we're having. As well, when we see these cheese exports not going out, we're going to see an increase in the supply. Increase in supply means that there's going to be a lot more for us to take and the prices are going to go down, which means we have to find alternative markets to ship these products to. Finding them is going to take some cost because there has to be some reallocation cost and also some agreements that would, in the short term to about mid-term and long-term, there may be some, you know, structural cost there that farmers would have to face before things get back on. So the impact is going to hit Wisconsin farmers big, but we hope that these negotiations are done as quickly as possible so that we can see the best out for our Wisconsin farmers.
We'll be watching for that. Kelvin, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelvin Amon is an assistant professor of dairy business and economic development in the UW-Platteville School of Agriculture with us today to look at how retaliatory tariffs from Canada could impact Wisconsin's dairy industry. Earlier, we heard from Wisconsin Farmers Union President Darren Van Ruden about how farmers in the state are navigating these changes.
Coming up, the White House wants to eliminate a decades-old federal policy that protects millions of acres of wilderness from new roads and logging. What does it mean for the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest?
By repealing the rule, they're really removing the guarantee or the commitment that we're going to keep wild places wild.
Reactions to a proposal to get rid of the roadless rule, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thousands of Wisconsin homes still struggle to get basic internet.
In some rural areas, that's true even after the installation of broadband infrastructure. As Avery Martinez reports, some rural homes are trapped in the last mile between infrastructure and usability.
Every morning, Mike Hesse steps out the front door to a rude awakening.
That's how close fiber internet is to my farm home here.
From his porch, he points to an orange and white post in his front yard. It's a utility cap.
You got the vault 60 feet from my house, and you cannot hook us up.
And even though an internet line goes through his yard, and he mows around it each week, Hesse says it's only for businesses.
I just love to have him connect me from that box to my house.
His home in northeast La Crosse County near the Jackson border is just one of thousands across Wisconsin sitting beside working internet lines but unable to connect. Wisconsin has spent years incentivizing quality internet lines and infrastructure through grants and programs, but getting rural homes connected is still a challenge, even in areas with broadband upgrades.
That final mile is always the hardest to manage. There's a lot of complexities to getting fiber to the home with right-of-ways and easements and access.
That's Jackson County's Economic Development Director, Ken Pearson. He says there's still little incentive for internet providers to prioritize rural connections.
Those legacy providers want to go to the high-density hubs. That's where they make the most money. They want to have anchor tenants, usually in industry, manufacturing, So from a business standpoint, it makes sense why they do that.
Pearson says that impacts economic growth, schools, and property values. Jennifer Jennings runs Creekside Kennels and Shops in Jackson County. She's gone through multiple service providers trying to find one that works.
There's less customers out here, so the priority level for rural areas, whether it's in Jackson County here or elsewhere, is, I'm sure, pretty low for these companies.
She says it's affected her business.
Just the fact that we're rural doesn't mean we're not important.
Hesse's frustrated because the line through his lawn services a cell tower next door, but he can't access it. Even though he's tried several times, he wasn't successful. So instead, he's had to settle for a slow DSL connection.
Basically, four copper lines bonded together to get me up to 20 megs.
20 megabytes per second is below what the state considers basic internet speed. It can take minutes to download a PDF.
And jump from this site to that site or whatever, it takes time, and it depends about where you're located.
And customers in most cities are at 100 megs.
And I've got neighbors who are begging and pleading, please, we'd like to be able to get at least 10 megs.
Hesse feels he's living rougher on the farm than his grandmother, who depended on catalogs and steam engines to stay connected to the world.
The mail was sorted on the train. Generally, the next day, she had her order, you know, a century ago.
And you can't download a PDF
And I can't.
The state estimates 165,000 places in Wisconsin lack access to high-speed internet. Many are smaller communities still trying to solve internet problems, like Jackson County, which Pearson said prioritizes web infrastructure as community development.
The long-term deliverability of having reliable high-speed internet brings advantage to our community. All of a sudden, families stay longer. They're invested in the community longer. They may decide that they want to move to the area instead of vacationing here.
For Mike Hesse, though, each night when he pulls into the driveway, he sees the orange and white pole.
For the life of me on this, the infrastructure's here. You know, I know it's active because you're providing service to the cell tower over here. What is the big problem?
Reminding him that fiber internet is under his lawn, but out of reach. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Avery Martinez.
This is WPR News.
The Trump administration announced a proposal last month to get rid of the U.S. Forest Service's Roadless Area Conservation Rule. It was adopted in 2001, and it protects millions of acres from logging, road building, and other development on national forest lands.
According to the Department of Agriculture, more than 95% of roadless areas are in 10 western states, but the roadless rule applies to 69,000 acres of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin.
The Forest Service says that the rule is preventing effective fire management in these areas and that it takes away and that taking it away will offer land managers more flexibility.
A 30-day public comment period on the proposal and the draft environmental impact statement is open until September 21st.
Mike Dombeck is a Wisconsin conservationist who served as U.S. Forest Service chief from 1997 to 2001 and was instrumental in putting the roadless rule in place. Mike, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you, Kate. I'm pleased to be here.
What was the rationale for this rule at that time in 2001?
Well, Kate, it's really a long story, and I'll try to be brief. In the 1940s, we had about 100,000 miles of roads on the 193 million acres of national forest. But the war effort, World War II, required an increase in timber harvest to meet the war demands, to provide housing for soldiers returning from World War II, and to get the wood out of the forest, obviously, you'll need roads. And most of the eastern national forests were cut, and a lot of this occurred in the west, where you had steep mountainous terrains. And by the 1980s, we had over 300,000 miles of roads on the national forest system. And those roads were largely paid for by timber receipts, the funds that the sale of timber brought. And in 1989, all things changed. Most of the large old growth timber was harvested. The funding for the roads program disappeared. So it largely became a funding issue. And it also became a controversial issue because now to get more timber out, we had to go into more backcountry areas, wilder places, more rugged terrain. And also we had more low-value timber because the easy stuff was cut. Hmm. So this became the surrogate for entering backcountry for cutting old growth. And in 1997, we came within one vote of the House of Representatives of losing 80% of the Forest Service growth budget. So initially, it's an economic issue. It's a taxpayer liability. We had $8.6 billion backlog in road maintenance with only 13% of the national forest system roads in good condition and over 50% in bad condition. So we had this amazing problem that was a fiscal problem, that was an environmental problem, and actually a transportation system problem. Now, it's important for listeners to understand how big this road system is. 386,000 miles yeah. on 193 million acres of land. The interstate system is 46,000 miles across the entire United States. The distance to the moon is 239,000 miles. And here we have 386,000 miles of roads on 193 million acres of land. So we had, you know, controversy, budget issues, and so on. So I asked myself as chief, well, what would a private landowner do? What would a timber company do if they were faced with this tremendous liability, this tremendous cash flow issue? They'd probably stop building roads or at least evaluate the system.
But the rescission, it removes the national designation of roadless areas, but it's not like a mandate to start more timber harvesting or to start building more roads?
Well, the rescission itself does not remove the roadless areas. What it does is it removes the guarantee that the roadless values will continue to be protected. Mm-hmm. The values of clean water, the values of large undeveloped tracts of land, the few tracts of land in the United States that are remaining that have values for you know, high quality habitats, rare and endangered species, the best water quality coming off of our forested landscapes or coming off of these lands. So by repealing the rule, they're really removing the guarantee or the commitment that we're going to keep wild places wild.
We're also hearing that this is a one-size-fits-all rule that doesn't allow for flexibility in how these areas are managed. And we had a statement from the spokesperson for the Forest Service who said, quote, rescinding the rule allows managers to address local watershed, economic, and wildfire risk conditions within the same planning framework as the rest of the national forest system and allows response to changing conditions. Why not allow that flexibility at the local level?
Well, number one, the flexibility is there right now. Hmm. The one thing you cannot do in a roadless area is have a commercial timber harvest and build a permanent road. All other prior existing rights, mining claims, recreation activities are allowed in roadless areas. So this is simply not true.
Wildfire management is, you know, at the forefront of the rationale for getting rid of this rule. What is known about the frequency and severity of wildfires that happen in roadless areas?
Well, regarding fire, most of the fire starts ignitions that occur on national forests and across the U.S. are human-caused and not intentional. Sparks from equipment, automobile accidents, motorcycle accidents, heat from mufflers in real dry conditions. And most of those starts occur within a half mile of a road. So the higher density of roads you have, the higher probability of fire. In fact, if we look at the fire ignitions, we have something significantly lower ignitions in these backcountry areas than we do in more highly populated areas where we have, you know, more people and more people using the forest. And again, I want to emphasize that most of these ignitions are accidental. It's important to understand with fire that 97% of the fires are already suppressed in the United States, and the 3% that get away are extreme. so extreme that it's really unsafe to send firefighters in there. Even air suppression does not work. So this idea that we need to build roads in these areas to protect them from fire, the data, even the Forest Service's own data, just does not support this.
Wisconsin has 69,000 acres of inventoried roadless areas. How do you see the impact to the Shawamigan-Nicolet Fort National Forest if this rule is repealed?
Here in Wisconsin, the impact will actually be minor. What we're losing is we're losing the guarantee that these places will be left wild. And many of them are surrounded by wetlands. They're in research natural areas. They're in state designated natural areas or surrounding them. That's what we lose here in this state. You know, in my view, this is a very conservative policy. Number one, it doesn't cost taxpayer money. We're not spending money building a road system, then that creates a long-term liability. And number two, it keeps options open for future generations. And number three, it's good conservation, ensuring that our few last wild remaining places in the United States will be kept that way.
Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
That is Mike Dombeck, a Wisconsin conservationist who served as U.S. Forest Service chief from 1997 to 2001. He was instrumental in creating the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule, which halted new road building and logging in specific areas within national forests. The Trump administration is proposing getting rid of that rule to allow for more flexibility in management and development. Now for the perspective of the people who use these areas for recreation, we're joined by Aaron Habeisen, Field Operations Coordinator for States in the Upper Midwest at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. It's a conservation organization. Aaron, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Who does your group represent in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so Backcountry Hunters and Anglers seeks to be the voice of wild public lands, waters, and wildlife across the country. And we have currently 900 or so Wisconsin registered BHA members. But whether you are a hunter or an angler, backpacker, bird watcher, paddler, berry picker, anybody who's recreating on public lands, we try and support and defend those places, protect them for all users.
In and around Wisconsin, how accessible are these roadless areas for hunters and for anglers with this rule in place for the past, you know, roughly quarter century?
Yeah, they're you know, in my experience, extremely accessible. In some of the inventoried roadless areas I go to, you know, you're still taking a vehicle to the trailhead, and then it is an option for you either to go in by foot traffic or to travel on a ATV or OHV or on a bike.
With the proposed rule, what is your organization's position on the roadless area conservation rule?
Yeah, so currently there's a comment period open until September 21st, and there are three alternatives outlined. Alternative one would be taking no action and no change to the existing roadless rule. Alternative two would have some impact. And then alternative three, my understanding is that it would be a complete rescission of the existing roadless rule. And so BHA supports alternative one, which would be no change to the existing roadless rule. The existing roadless rule is really a great middle ground. We view that as something that offers the broadest level of opportunity. So whether you are going in with a motorized vehicle, there are trails in place as long as you're staying on those trails and not creating new ones or boondocking off the existing trails. You can stay on those trails and still access a large chunk of those big swaths that he was talking to. And by removing the accessibility, I would say, of the possibility of more motorized access, it's going to provide a better experience for the non-motorized user.
So the group Blue Ribbon Coalition, it tries to preserve recreation on public lands, and it says the same roads that let a fire crew in are the roads that let a hunter, an older rider, or a family who cannot hike 10 miles into the backcountry reached the public land they've explored for generations before the rule. Would these roads, would the rule, rescinding the rule, make these roads more accessible, make more options available?
Potentially for those folks. But again, there's already roads in place. And with the number of roads that already exist, those folks still have an opportunity to experience that backcountry space without adding additional economic impact, extra infrastructure, and requiring extra upkeep and enforcement of new roads. We already have trouble through the U.S. Forest Service in managing what we've got. And so to add more roads is just going to be more area that unfortunately is going to go unmaintained.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That is Aaron Haybison, Field Operations Coordinator for States in the Upper Midwest at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. That's a conservation organization. Earlier, we heard from Mike Dombeck, a Wisconsin conservationist who served as U.S. Forest Service Chief from 1997 to 2001. Dombeck was instrumental in creating the 2001 Roadless Rule. The decades-old federal policy halted new road building, logging, and development in millions of acres of national forest wilderness, including 69,000 acres of the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest in northern Wisconsin. The Forest Service is gathering public comments on its proposal to end the Roadless Rule until September 21st.
Coming up, performers at Nahale Studios near Milwaukee gear up for the Midwest Aloha Festival in Menominee Falls. The theme of the festival is True Colors,
which celebrates the authenticity of the human spirit in line with the Nui Nui, what you might know as the rainbow.
Get a preview of the festival and its music. That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About 2,500 Native Hawaiians and other Pacific Islander residents call Wisconsin home.
For many of these people, it's important to honor their ancestry and pass cultural traditions on to the next generation.
That is the goal behind Nahale Studios, a cultural center in Butler, northwest of Milwaukee, with a mission to enrich the Polynesian community in the region through dance, art, music, and culture.
The performers at Nahale are gearing up for the first Midwest Aloha Festival that takes place in Menominee Falls on September 19th.
Malia Chow is the founder of Nahale Studios. Angela Cuevas is a professional hula dancer and musician in Milwaukee. And Kaleo Lee is a fire dancer and musical performer who plays the drums, bass, and ukulele. They are instructors at Nahale Studios. Malia, Angel, and Kalale, welcome to our WPR studio.
Thank you so much. Mahalo.
Thank you so much. This is so exciting.
Thank you very much. Very excited to be here.
Malia, starting with you, how did you become a professional hula dancer?
So my mom was born in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin, 6 foot tall, blonde hair, blue eyed, German French. She was stationed in the Air Force in Honolulu in the late 60s. And while she was out there, she met my father, who was a Native Hawaiian musician born in 1946. He was also an Army vet as well. And after they met, they stayed in Hawaii for quite some time. They returned home in the early 1980s with a set of twins, for which I am one of those twins. So at 4 years old, I started dancing hula out here in Wisconsin. the promise that my father and mother gave my dad's family before leaving Hawaii, specifically to my grandma, was that if we were to leave the islands, that we were to continue our culture and never forget where we came from. So while my dad was playing in bars and pubs as a Hawaiian musician for hula dancers and groups here, we grew up in the same situation. At 4 years old, we were already performing. And by the time we were 16 years old, we eventually became professional dancers. We grew up very similarly to, a Hawaiian partridge family or like the Jacksons, you know, where like what we did was very, very strict in performance. It was our way of life and we did it all the time. And so in 1996, we started out professionally and that makes 30 years. And that's actually how I came to know Angel as well, too.
Oh, Angel, how did you start hula dancing? What is your origin story?
Okay, so basically our moms went to high school together. They're both blonde hair, blue-eyed. My parents actually met in Hawaii when my mom was there on vacation. And my dad had been in Hawaii for a few years from the Philippines. Mm. And so kind of a long story short, you know, they come to back to Wisconsin to live, and Malia's parents wanted to start this group. And so I have the Hawaiian look, you know, and so basically they invited me on.
Yeah.
How does it make you feel to dance?
It's awesome. It's emotional, you know, spiritual. It's all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Kaleo, you grew up in a musical family and play a lot of instruments, drums, ukulele. How did you get involved in playing Native Hawaiian music?
It started off, I think I made it to 7 years old without ever having any interest at all. And then we went to a performance in Chicago. There was an old restaurant. It was called Shanghai Lil's, and a lot of people enjoyed going there. Mm-hmm. We went there and I saw a performance and I saw the fire dancer. And I remember my mom saying, "Hey, do you want to learn how to do that?" And I said, "Oh yeah," being the tough guy that I thought I was as a little kid. Well, turns out she was serious. And I did. Started at 7. Now, when you do fire knife, you start off with small fire. You don't okay. put a lot of fire. And then when you perform, you step off to the side and you're, let the rest of the adults take care of the rest of the performing. But my dad would say, "Hey, grab a pair of sticks, grab that drum and begin." And he knew I had an interest. I was having a blast doing that too. So then he would sit me down with my uncles and they would show me different drum beats. And then eventually I learned bass guitar because they were saying, "Hey, if you're interested, grab that bass and I'll teach you how to tune it and play a couple notes." And then I just ran with it. Everything they gave me, my parents would leave the instruments out in our home and we would play like as kids run around. But every once in a while we come by and we pick it up and we honor it. We play a couple of chords, put it down. Mm-hmm. And that's how they spoon fed me the instruments and my sister too. So that's how we got into it. And that was 52 years ago and never looked back. It's been just go, go, go. And I've been having a blast.
Malia, in terms of the community that you bring together at your studio, can you first explain what does nahale mean?
Sure. Nahale is two words. The first word, na, is plural. So hale means houses. So it means many houses. And when you come from halau or traditional hula schools, hula schools are operated by a master or a kumu hula. And in the traditional sense, when you operate a halau, they are about a life way. So hula is not just about being on the stage. It's not just about performance. It's not just about being in the classroom. It's about a way that you walk in the world with humility, with aloha, with discipline. And being that they're in Wisconsin, at least to my knowledge, there are no kumu hula. So in order to be a master hula teacher, you have to undergo a lifetime or a serious endeavor of study by which only a kumu hula can uniki you or graduate you to that title. And being that I grew up really heavily immersed in the culture, but I did not have that official title. And there are many other culture keepers in the Midwest. I felt that instead of a halal, which really quite literally means a house, even though it's a hula school, that if we had many houses or many sources of knowledge, and I call these people culture keepers, whether they're kumuhula, hula masters or not, that if we pieced together the things that we had, that we could weave together Nahale Studios, which is really our mission is to enrich and inspire lives through dance, culture, music, wellness, art, community, in the spirit of aloha and in honor of indigenous wisdom and its ability to nurture and unify people on the planet. Mm. And it really was... not only to protect culture in the way that I knew how, but to seek our elders, to seek our knowledge holders, and to give them a space where they could continue to perpetuate that knowledge.
Mm. Your grandmother, your ancestors mm-hmm. would be so proud.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mahalo for that.
Angel, how do you communicate through hula dancing? What is that emotion like?
I would say it's just dancing alone is very, obviously expressive. But when it's for the actual culture, it just means so much more. And there's so many different dances that we actually do. We're actually Polynesian dancers. And so we do Samoan, from Tahiti, New Zealand, Hawaiian.
Yeah.
My favorite is actually called Awana, and it's like a slow hula, and we do it in English and Hawaiian, so.
We're talking about Native Hawaiian culture here in Wisconsin ahead of the first Midwest Aloha Festival on September 19th in Menominee Falls. We're joined by Malia Chow, founder of Nahale Studios in Butler. And along with us is Angel Cuevas and Kaleo Lee, their performers and instructors at Nahale Studios. Kaleo, in terms of the festival, what kind of musical performances are you and your students preparing for this big day?
We're going to perform music from Hawaii. We're going to do it's called the Siva Afi, which is a fire dance that's from Samoa. We have Tahitian drumming from Tahiti, and honestly, that's one of my fortes, and I enjoy that so much. The energy from the drumming from Tahiti is exciting, and it really is. And now we're doing something different that I have not done before, and I get to do this with Nahale. We have almost a story that's being told, and we insert some music in between the drumming, and there's responses from the dancers, against the drummers. It's got so much in there. It's kind of got a little bit of everything, so that's very exciting for me, and I know everybody else is having a blast preparing for this big event.
What is the story about? Could you share that?
Maybe Malia could help me with that.
Just to speak on it overall and in regards to the Midwest Aloha Festival, being that this is our inaugural event, the first year's theme that we came up with was True Colors, which celebrates the authenticity of the human spirit. And in line with the Nui Nui, or the what you might know as the rainbow, for Hawaiians and our ancestral beliefs, we believe that the rainbow is a pathway by which our ancestors communicate with us and give us messages. And so the way that I prompted our cultural artists was, hey, what's going on in the world right now? And they were pointing out things like our culture keepers were like, well, greed, racial divide, financial disparity. And what we did is we took those ideas and we wrote them down on the board and we said, well, what is the opposite of those things? What is the medicine of those things? And for, like racial divide, that medicine is unity. And I said, all right, well, then if you need to take a principle of respect, and I want you to write a song about respect, and let's coordinate it to a color of the rainbow.
Mm.
And what Kaleo is doing, that drum piece, is specifically about love.
Mm. Wow. Angel, what does it mean to have this type of festival here in Wisconsin? And what does True Colors mean to you and what you've contributed?
Oh, it's so awesome because I don't think that there has ever been any festival, like this. So it's exciting to be the first group to, put this on. And so it's really exciting. Yeah. And the True Colors, it's awesome. I hope that you guys can see part of this production because we do the actual True Colors, but we do it in, I'm actually the one that sings it. Mm-hmm. And we do
And by True Colors, she means the Cyndi Lauper.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The actual song.
Yes. The song True Colors.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we do the actual song, and we do some of it in Hawaiian, and some of it is in English. So.
Oh,
yeah, it's really awesome. It's one of everyone's favorite songs. Everyone's wearing a different color, and it's really beautiful.
Kaleo, what does it mean for you to be a culture bearer and pass these musical traditions on to the next generation?
That's an opportunity, an honor, actually. When I perform, it's not just for myself or whoever's in the room. I kind of think that people that have taught me who are no longer with us can hear from above, and I would want them to hear it done properly. And so, for example, I never wanted to have that sensation of I'm just singing to sing. I sing a song, one is called Makalapua, and whenever I sing it, I'm singing it to my relatives that I think can hear me. Mm-hmm. And I sing it in a way that I need them to know, hey, we did not forget anything you taught us about that song. And I used to teach my daughters. I have four daughters, and we used to just sing at the dining room table or in the car. But one of them, I remember asking me when some of the grandparents had passed away, they're like, oh, do you think they can hear us? And I said, absolutely. Mm. And that changed the whole attitude behind what we're singing. They were able to emote as if they're still here. And we grew with that concept. And I believe it today that when we're singing some of these songs, they can hear it. And if they don't hear it, I still think of when we sing together, when they were here with us. So it is an honor to be able to continue that. And then maybe another generation will carry it further, hopefully.
Thank you for that. Well, thank you all, Malia, Angel, and Kaleo. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
An honor.
Thank you so much.
That was Malia Chow, Angel Cuevas, and Kaleo Lee. They are dancers and performers from the Nahali Studios outside of Milwaukee. We've been talking about their work at the Cultural Center as they prepare for the first ever Midwest Aloha Festival in Menominee Falls on September 19th.
Midterm election day is just 2 months away, with races for governor, attorney general, Congress, and the state legislature on the ballot here in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Public Radio is putting together a midterm election voter guide, getting candidates answers to questions on important issues, and we want your help.
What questions do you want candidates in federal and state elections to answer as they compete for your vote?
You can share your questions online. Go to WPR.org/elections to submit a question or topic you want to ask candidates about.
Get your question in by the end of the week. Again, that website is WPR.org/elections.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Beatrice Lawrence, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.